Good afternoon. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. 101.3 FM on your dial. And we are streaming on freakradio.org. Streaming at freakradio.org. Don't forget to click on that red oval for the free streaming link. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren, at 3:03 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This March 24th, 2014. And if that jives with your own personal time-space continuum, you know that the show is live and you may call in at any time at your convenience, so long as the show is live. Here's the phone number into the studio. Area code, as they say, 831-427-3772. Don't worry, I'll give it to you again and later on. Area 831-427-3772. All the proper associated buttons on the phone set are pressed. The Gentner is turned off, but that means the lines are open. 831-427-3772. A little more music from Azza here in Santa Cruz on the west coast of North America. Many's to talk about today, so let's get right to it, folks. Again, my name is Ren Tawil, the host of the Mideast Migraine Show here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I am your friendly neighborhood Palestinian American. I think that says enough about where my sentiment lies. But I think it also important to maintain the fact that we're all interested in truth, justice, and the global village way. I certainly am. If you want to call what I have to talk about as propaganda, go ahead if it makes you feel good. The important thing is, as far as I can tell, I'm providing a viewpoint which is sorely still lacking. Even here on Pirate Underground Community Radio, not nearly enough is said about the alternate narrative, which is to say the story of the Palestinian people about what really happened in the first part of the 20th century. And events following the Second World War, and particularly from November 1947 until the beginning of 1949, which accounts for the foundation of the modern-day state of Israel and all the fighting that occurred perpetrated by both sides in that period of time. Lately, though, I have been making a bit of an effort to slightly spread out a bit from the what to a lot of people I'm sure is a rather mundane topic of Arabs and Israelis, Jews and Muslims, Palestine this, Israel that. Let it never be said that I am afraid to talk about the ills and the crimes perpetrated by the other countries in the Middle East, the other Arab nations. This is dated March 24, which would be today, Monday. From Code Pink. Code Pink, Women for Peace. Dear Lawrence, in a shocking move, an Egyptian court has sentenced 529 supporters of former President Mohamed Morsi to death. I'll say it again. An Egyptian court has sentenced 529 supporters of former President Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood Party. He was deposed by the military. Supporters of President Morsi to death for the killing of a single police officer. Yes, you heard me right. And this dispatch from Code Pink wants me to sign their petition. We need your help to prevent this mass slaughter from happening. Tell the Egyptian government to lift the outrageous death sentence for the 529 convicted Egyptians. Since overthrowing the Morsi government in July 2013, the Egyptian military has killed over 1,000 people and jailed over 16,000. It is clearly targeting people based on political affiliation. Amnesty International has called this the largest group death sentence anywhere in the world in recent years. Help, and then it says, help us get the court ruling reversed now by sending a message to Egypt's Army Chief and Defense Minister, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. If you're in the D.C. area, and this Mideast Migraines, as it's called now, program being available online on the World Wide Web, I'm anxious to point this out, that if you're in the D.C., Washington, D.C. area, join us on Thursday, March 27. Okay. That's this Thursday. Join us on Thursday, March 27 at noon at the Egyptian Embassy, 3521 International Court, Northwestern District of Columbia, to protest this terrible injustice. Or call the embassy and leave them a message at this phone number, area code 202-895-5400. Again, area code 202-895-5400. In peace, Ali Kamen Farah, Janet Jody Kate, Lisa Medea, Nancy, Sarah, Sergey and Ty. P.S. Read more about the sentencing in Medea Benjamin's article entitled Egypt's Kangaroo Court Sentences 529 Morsi Supporters to Death. Okay, for me, it's a simple matter of clicking on something, which I will not take the time to do during the show, but later, I think I might have already done this. For you, simply go to Code Pink, to their website. It's fascinating how often they don't put down their simple expression of their website. Their email address is info@codepink.org. That's codepink.org, info@codepink.org. But that's their email. Just Google or otherwise do a search for Code Pink or Code Pink. And you'll definitely find a link with that site so you too may sign the petition. Yes. Egypt still being in a somewhat subdued character for the moment in their ongoing revolution is in the midst of a revolution, a democratic revolution. That is the hope and aim. Truly democratic change. It's remarkable how much, what a drastic change this has been from the days of Hosni Mubarak, president of Egypt. Just the very title infers that the guy was elected, but of course that was a sham of an election. Every time they elected and re-elected old Mubarak. And it was a dynasty. He was, if it weren't for the Arab Spring as it took place in Egypt 3 years ago, there clearly would have been an open path for Hosni Mubarak's son, whose name I can no longer even remember, to simply replace his roughly 80-year-old father at the next election. But that obviously appears to be out of the question. Yes, folks, 529 sentenced to death. Now let's go ahead and go back to... Wait. Not quite to Israel-Palestine yet. Israel/Palestine. Here is a dispatch from the American Arab Anti-Discrimination, or ADC. This is not to be confused with the ADL. ADL stands for the Anti-Defamation League, which was founded some 30, 40-odd years ago, I believe, by Jews who exert really all of their energies into not only exposing and condemning or persecuting anyone who partakes in anti-Semitic activity, anyone who does anything to promote hatred for the Jews or the Jewish faith. Not only does the ADL do what they can to prevent that, but the ADL is highly instrumental in persecuting any activity, no matter what, how peaceful its intent. If it is directed towards supporting the Arabs, in particular, supporting and expressing solidarity with the Palestinian Arabs, the ADL is constantly making, however loose or even false the connections are, of these peace-seeking solidarity people to terrorists and to those, and supposedly to those who want to destroy Israel. This is not the ADL. This is the ADC. American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. This is their weekly digest newsletter. In particular, breaking news. Disney and the ABC family drop Alice in Arabia, quote unquote. Alice in Arabia, March 21. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC, welcomes the decision by the Disney company, parent company of ABC and ABC Family, you know, like the Family Channel on TV, to cancel the show Alice in Arabia. ABC Family had purchased a pilot of the controversial show, and after coming under pressure from ADC, our partners, the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CAIR, C-A-I-R, and the Muslim Public Affairs Council, MPAC, the show was canceled. And ADC does offer its text of its original statement to Disney on its site. Continues to say, ADC welcomes the decision to drop the show and hopes that the Disney company will work towards resolving other issues raised, such as the depiction of Arabs in the series Once Upon a Time, the TV show Once Upon a Time, as well as issues surrounding the Aladdin musical. Aladdin, of course, was a musical animated feature a number of years ago now, and I think they're talking about a Broadway version or a live stage version of Aladdin as a musical. I think that's the case. Anyway, continuing with the ADC statement, in a statement sent to the ADC, Disney stated, quote, the current conversation surrounding our pilot was not what we had envisioned and is certainly not conducive to the creative process, so we've decided not to move forward with this project, end quote. ADC President Samir Khalaf said, we welcome the decision by the Disney company to cancel the show. By doing so, the Disney company, the ABC family, have rid themselves of a show that did nothing but perpetuate demanding stereotypes. Moving forward, we encourage other media outlets to stay away from such programming and not engage in the stereotyping of any community. We look forward to continued dialogue and conversation with the Disney company. End quote. According to the official synopsis, Alice in Arabia is a television show about an American teenager who is kidnapped by her relatives and taken to Saudi Arabia, where she is kept as a prisoner in her Muslim grandfather's home. According to ABC's plot summary, Alice must count on her independent spirit and wit to find a way to return home while surviving life behind the veil. ADC strongly believes that imagery of the Arab and Muslim community as portrayed in the Alice in Arabia plot summary perpetuates demeaning stereotypes. I think I said demanding earlier when I should have read demeaning. Perpetuates demeaning stereotypes. The imagery and depiction of the respective communities as kidnappers and oppressors of women reinforces harmful stereotypical depictions of the communities as thieves, criminals, persons who engage in violent acts, captives, and or persecutors. Communities as thieves, criminals, persons who engage in violent acts, captives, and or persecutors. Just took a quick peek up to the top shelf here, looking for some tissue to wipe my eyeglasses with. Did I mention I'm turning 61 in 3 months? In less than 3 months. Kind of scary, huh? Not so much for me, but for anyone who imagines what it's like to suffer from that predicament. Okay. Back to reality here. And clear eyeglasses. Clear lenses. Continuing, in a letter to the chief executive officer of the American Broadcasting Company's ABC family, Robert Iger, ADC President Samir Khalaf stated, quote, by purchasing the pilot, ABC family has reinforced these damning views and has shown the world that there is a market for hate and bigotry. ABC family and the Walt Disney Company, as a major programming source for American children, adolescents, and families, possess immense influence on the American zeitgeist and next generation, and have a duty to exert that influence in a meaningful, positive way, not one that demonizes a people, a religion, and a region. Associated article on BuzzFeed, ABC Family Kills Alice in Arabia. Okay, now I know what a lot of you are thinking and possibly even screaming back into your radio at me, at the people who wrote this. But isn't it true that Muslims, whether they're Arabs or non-Arabs, do kidnap or children of the immediate family, or perhaps fool the spouse, parent, of such children into coming to the old country, and none of them are able to escape again. Well, those images, those stories, were initially made famous here in the West by the film starring Sally Field, Not Without My Daughter, and another very similar, essentially same message, TV movie, with the oh-so-lovely Mariel Hemingway playing the mother. Those were renditions of events that had happened based on true life. I'm not going to try to convince anyone that these things do not happen. I don't think it's ADC's aim to try to convince someone that this is all fabrication, that it's a complete myth that this happens. I do not support the kidnapping of anyone for any purpose that I can think of at the moment, but that's neither here nor there. It's very sad when these things do occur, but I still believe that ADC is right on, since they're talking about primarily programming which is directed primarily at children and adolescents and considered to be family programming. In my opinion, television audiences are, by and large, influenced to way too strong a degree by the imagery, both visual and audio, from what they see on their television sets. And these images and the resulting conclusions, intellectual conclusions that people can come to, are far too influential, far too strong. No matter how based in any degree of reality, what ADC is concerned about is the stereotyping. That's why it's called stereotyping. It multiplies a cascading variety of images to the viewer, to the experiencer, and blows them way out of proportion, especially when we're talking about delivering this stuff to kids and adolescents. Now, if any of us, myself included, any of my listeners out there, want to affect the phenomenon of anyone doing any kind of kidnapping, whether it's in the family, extended family, or having nothing to do with heritagical families, there are other outlets for dealing with this. But just to deliver raw images like that as a form of entertainment, ADC is saying, and I agree with them, that this is inappropriate. There's nothing, as they put down here, it's not positive. It's not constructive. It strongly tends to demonize religions, peoples, and regions. Okay, item and comment delivered. Let's move on. Now we're getting to Israel and Palestine directly. March 20, which would have been last Thursday, English News, that's english.news.cn. .ca would be Canada, so I can't think exactly what .cn is. I suppose I could have looked it up before I started the show, but this is from English.news.cn. Poll shows most Palestinians are dissatisfied with the peace process. Ramallah, the current de facto provisional capital of Palestine. I still hesitate to say the Free State of Palestine, not because the Palestinian leaders are necessarily imprisoning anyone, but the whole notion of a free Palestine is being kept under wraps by the Israelis. They're prohibiting the existence of a free Palestine. Anyway, from Ramallah, March 19, Xinhua Press. An absolute majority among the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip believe that things are heading in the wrong direction, a public opinion survey showed on Wednesday. 66% of the 1,200 people, sample people, 1,200 sample people, believe that things are heading in the wrong direction, while 49%, just under half, said they are pessimistic about the future, according to the study conducted in the Gaza Strip in the West Bank by the Arab World Research and Development Center, or ARAD. The poll, which was published on last Wednesday, March 19, showed that 53% of respondents say that their family's economic situation is worse than it was only a year ago. In contrast, 33% of them said that it has stayed the same. So that's just about two-thirds of the respondents in the survey confirming that their family's economic situation has not improved. And most of them, of that two-thirds, say that it's gotten worse. Continuing, the Gaza Strip, ruled by Hamas movement, has been under a tight Israeli blockade and Egyptian security measures for around 8 years, while the West Bank suffers from expansion of Israeli settlement and deteriorated economy. Due to the Israeli policies, rates of poverty and unemployment, mainly in Gaza, have grown. Rates of poverty and unemployment, mainly in Gaza, have grown, while a stalemate peace process has created a status of disappointment among the Palestinians. The poll said that 52% support a two-state solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, while 46% oppose. I'm going to cut in here. This does not necessarily mean that that 46% opposing necessarily supports war. It doesn't mean that they necessarily support ongoing conflict. It simply says that they do not support a two-state solution. Perhaps those 46% who oppose support a one-state solution, a single democratic and secular, non-religious-oriented state in Israel and Palestine, be founded, be birthed, with truly equal rights, including rights of property, marriage, place in society, access to education and employment, all that stuff, be absolutely equitable. Opportunities for those things be equal. And I'm distracted here, folks, because there's some scary soundings coming from right outside the window. There is some... The city is doing some work with heavy machinery on the street, right outside the building here. And I trust you can hear me clearly, but it's kind of pissing me off. It's not one thing, it's another here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, liberating the airwaves since 1995. Broadcasting at 101.3 FM. And streaming online at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the streaming link. It's 3:31, by the way. 3:31 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. Here in good old California. I can't shut the window either. Maybe I can. Hang on. Yeah, that's much better. Nothing like giving someone something a second look and making a little effort there. Yes, I succeeded in shutting the window almost entirely. It's got some stuff in front of it, so it's hard for me to close it airtight. Okay. This is the Mideast Migraine Show at Free Radio Santa Cruz, your underground community radio station, in deliberate defiance of the Federal Communications Commission regulations concerning audio transmission on the airwaves, and perhaps to some degree on the internet, This is an ongoing expression of civil disobedience against corporate-ruled commercial radio. That's what we're about. Where was I in this article? I think I was adding my 2 cents concerning... 46% opposing a two-state solution, hopeful solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Doesn't mean they want war. They might prefer a one-state solution, which I see no problem with. That should not threaten anyone, be they Jews, Muslims, Christians, or none of the above. They may support something that's called dual nationality state, a single state of dual nationality. I'm not even sure how that works. I don't think that that idea has a large following either. But that's what that is. Okay, getting back to the article per se, directly. The U.S.-sponsored peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians were resumed last July, and the two sides were given a 9-month ultimatum to hammer out a peace deal. Actually, it says to hammer out a peace deal. I'm sure the U must be an A. I'm not sure how you could hammer anything out. Okay, continuing. However, Israeli and Palestinian officials had earlier declared that no progress had been so far achieved. Even the visit of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to Washington and his meeting with President Barack Obama hadn't achieved any progress. The poll showed that 48% of respondents believe that the quote-unquote carry peace plan or framework agreement will fail in producing a final status agreement, adding, quote, 20 years after Oslo, 64% believe, said that's 64% believe, that Palestinians are now farther from achieving their goal of a Palestinian state, end quote. It also showed that 55% of respondents say that they have received limited or no information on the current round of negotiations, and that 49% support the current round of negotiations, while 44% oppose it. So at least you got roughly half of them who at least support the fact that there are ongoing negotiations, even though they're getting nowhere. Continuing, the poll said that 44% of Palestinians do not support a resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli situation involving further concessions, even if President Abbas states that it would best serve Palestinian interests. I'll say that again, just to we all understand. The poll said that 44% of Palestinians do not support a resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli situation involving further concessions, meaning concessions on the part of the Palestinians, even if, in the hypothetical circumstance that PA President Abbas states that it would best serve Palestinian interests. In other words, Palestinians, according to this poll, close to half, 44% of them, have said enough of us doing all the concessionizing. We have sacrificed enough. We're left with less than a quarter of the land that we had two-thirds of a century ago. We're supposed to give up more. Bull. That's what they're saying. Okay, continuing here with the article. Settle down, folks. Just calm down. It also showed that 77% of the respondents, that's over three quarters, 77% believe that the Palestinians are serious about negotiations leading to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, while only 13% believe the same about Israel. In other words, 13% of Palestinians believe that Israelis are serious about negotiations leading to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. Meaning 87% say, bull, Israel doesn't care about a free Palestinian state, regardless of whether or not that would lead to peace and justice and a viable economy for both countries. The survey was conducted on March 9 and 11 and published on Wednesday. Again, the survey conducted by AWRAD, ALRAD, the Arab World Research and Development Center. This, by way of a report through the Xinhua Press, I believe that's Chinese, X-I-N-H-U-A, in English, alliteration, March 19. Next item. These are actually three items. Whoops, we don't need that. Three items by way, no, two items coming to us from Haaretz, which is Israel's hottest daily news periodical, Haaretz, meaning the land or the land of Israel, but which contains a remarkable amount of eye-popping, eye-opening, very candid, intelligent opinion by a number of regular editorialists with Haaretz. Names like Gideon Levy come to mind, amongst others who are not coming to my mind. Palestinians seek Barghouti's release as a condition for extending the talks. A rising star in the dominant Fatah party, Fatah is still the dominant Palestinian political party, a rising star with them before he was captured by Israeli troops in 2002. Marwan Barghouti could be the key to keeping talks alive. The Associated Press, March 19, 6 days ago. The Palestinians are seeking the freedom of Marwan Barghouti, who is serving multiple life sentences for his alleged role in killings of Israelis as part of any plan to extend negotiations with Israel beyond an April deadline, several top officials said. A prominent Palestinian uprising leader, imprisoned by Israel, Barghouti could emerge as the key to keeping fragile U.S.-led peace efforts alive. A release of Barghouti, a popular figure among Palestinians, could inject new life into the troubled peace process, boost embattled Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, and even provide the Palestinians with a plausible successor to their 78-year-old leader, President Mahmoud Abbas. But Israel seems unlikely to approve the request, setting the stage for a possible breakdown in the talks. The Palestinians have two demands for an extension: a freeze in Israeli settlement construction in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and the release of the most senior prisoners held by Israel, first and foremost Barghouti, senior official Nabil Shath, and prisoner affairs minister Issa Karak. I better read that again. I misunderstood it, so I'm presuming you may have misunderstood it. Also, the Palestinians have two demands for an extension to the peace talks: a freeze in Israeli settlements, that would be Jewish-only residential settlement construction in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and two, the release of the most senior prisoners held by Israel, first and foremost Barghouti. As per what senior official Nabil Shath and prisoner affairs minister Issa Karak told Associated Press. That last two people are not in jail then. Israel was already forced to release dozens of prisoners convicted of deadly violence to make the current round of talks possible, but Barghouti remains jailed. With Israel not expected to halt settlement construction, the Palestinians say they will drive a tough bargain on the prisoner issue. Palestinian officials and Barghouti's family said Abbas, the president, raised the issue of Barghouti's release in his White House meeting this week. with President Barack Obama. President Abbas demanded the release of the political leaders in jail, like Marwan Barghouti, Ahmad Sadat, and Fuad Shobaki, said Karaki, the prisoner affairs minister. Issa Karaki is his name, not Karaki. Barghouti's wife, Fadwa, said Abbas is, and we quote here, exerting his efforts to release Marwan, and he's very serious about it. Israeli officials said the matter has not yet come in the talks. They spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to discuss the peace efforts with the Palestinians, to discuss to the press, or with the press, the peace efforts with the Palestinians. Sadat heads a faction that killed an Israeli cabinet minister in 2001 and is serving a 30-year sentence for allegedly participating in attacks. Shobaki, a former top Palestinian official, is the alleged mastermind of an attempt to smuggle a large shipment of weapons to the Palestinians on a ship that was intercepted by Israeli naval commandos in 2002. But no prisoner is no more prized by the Palestinians than Marwan Barghouti, who is a rising star in the dominant Fatah party, who was a rising star in the dominant Fatah party before he was captured by Israeli troops in 2002. Israel says Barghouti, now 54, was a leader of the violent uprising in the West Bank early last decade. He is serving 5 life terms for alleged involvement in the deaths of 4 Israelis and a Greek monk. The Palestinians say Barghouti is a politician who had no direct involvement in any of the killings. Barghouti's release could be critical for Abbas. The Palestinian leader has seen his popularity plummet, talking about President Abbas, due to the lack of progress in peace talks. Winning Barghouti's freedom would be a huge moral victory for him. And obviously, as according to this article, would also clear the way for a popular and fitting successor to Mr. Abbas, because he's on his way out anyway, quite obviously. Continuing with article. And at almost 79, Abbas has recently acknowledged that he cannot serve forever, yet he has never designated a successor and is facing a rising challenge from an exiled former aide, Mohamed Dahlan. Barghouti is perhaps the only member of Fatah's next generation of leaders with the gravitas to confront that challenge. Palestinian analyst Hani Al-Masri said Abbas desperately needs Barghouti's release, both to justify continued talks with Israel and to finally have a clear successor. Right, as I said. Fadwa Barghouti said her husband, imprisoned by the Israelis, remains intimately involved in Palestinian affairs from his cell in an isolated block of the Hadarim prison in central Israel. She said he shares a cell with 200 men and is allowed to go outdoors into a courtyard twice a day, 1 hour each time for exercise and a walk. She said he starts his day with exercise and then reads 4 Israeli newspapers. In addition to his native Arabic, Barghouti speaks Hebrew, the language of the Israelis, and English. As a member of Fatah's leadership, Barghouti is briefed on the negotiations through his wife, who is in close contact with the Palestinian leadership and visits him, her husband, twice a month. He was hoping that the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry would succeed in striking a deal based on the Israeli commitment to end the occupation based on the 1967 borders, she said. Barghouti, like other Palestinian leaders, wants to establish an independent state in all of the territories captured by Israel in 1967. The West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip, she said. Several past Israeli offers by more moderate governments than Netanyahu's seemed to come close, but ultimately fell short. The fate of the roughly 5,000 prisoners held by Israel is deeply emotional in Palestinian society. Virtually every Palestinian has a friend or relative who has served time in Israel, and the prisoners are revered as freedom fighters. Reminder, this article comes to us by way of Israel's biggest and by far most popular daily periodical, Haaretz. Continuing, but the issue is equally emotional for Israelis who see prisoners like Barghouti as terrorists. At the outset of talks last July, Israel agreed to release 104 long-serving prisoners in four stages. But the fourth and final stage, scheduled later this month, is suddenly in jeopardy. The previous releases, including dozens of men who were convicted in deadly attacks, have been accompanied by jubilant celebrations by Palestinians and attended by Hamas himself, angering many in Israel. On Tuesday, Israel's chief peace negotiator said the final release was not guaranteed unless there was progress in the talks. So, in other words, or in these words, according to this article, at the outset of the talks last July, Israel agreed to the four-stage release of 104 Palestinian prisoners, but is apparently ready to balk on that or renege on the completion of that deal unless there is progress in the talks. And the reason there is no progress in the talks is the intransigence, as always, or nearly always, on the part of the Israelis. How self-serving can we get? Continuing, for that reason, the release of Barghouti could become a contentious issue. In the coming weeks, Israeli officials have rejected repeated attempts to include him in past prisoner releases. Still, Israel could be tempted. During the peace talks of the 1990s, Barghouti was generally liked by the Israelis, had many friends among them, and was considered a moderate interlocutor. With many Israelis concerned that Abbas will be followed by more radical nationalists or Islamists, a Barghouti ascension, despite his supposed actions during the uprising, might not seem like the worst option. Without a significant gesture, the Palestinians could soon walk away from the negotiating table, as though the onus lies completely with the Palestinians for them to supposedly dash the negotiations and, as befitting many previous stereotypes of Palestinian negotiators, the Palestinians are the ones who ruin everything by walking away from the negotiating table. That's how this could be read. Continuing with the article, Shath gave a glimpse of what could lie ahead, saying the Palestinians would soon resume a campaign for United Nations recognition of the state of Palestine if Israel does not carry out the final scheduled prisoner release. Israel bitterly opposes the UN campaign, since the Palestinians have said they will use their enhanced international status to press for anti-Israel action. The Palestinians halted the campaign in exchange for Israel's pledge to free prisoners. We committed to not applying to the UN agencies and Israel committed to release 104 prisoners in four batches, he said, Mr. Schoth said. That was the deal. If Israel breaches it, we will too, end quote. Under heavy U.S. pressure, Israel and the Palestinians restarted negotiations last July, setting a nine-month target for wrapping up a comprehensive peace deal, establishing a Palestinian state, and ending a century of conflict. Roughly a century. After realizing this was unrealistic, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry scaled back his ambitions and said he would aim for a quote-unquote framework peace deal by the April deadline. With even that more modest goal in question, the sides are now searching for a formula that will allow the talks to continue. The Palestinians have been skeptical about the chances of success, distrusting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. A prolonging of the talks means continuing shelving of their previous plans to press for recognition, even without a peace deal with various international bodies. End of article. So, okay, a couple of major comments I have. It has been pointed out that some people have come forward, particularly since the death of former South African, liberated South African President Nelson Mandela, since his death, that the Palestinians need not only to provide them with I hate it when I can't come up with a simple word. In order to provide the Palestinians with the believable intention, and not to mention the actual establishment of a free, independent state of Palestine, that the Palestinians need a Mandela, as it were. There, somewhere in there is a Nelson Mandela necessary to interface with the Palestinians in negotiations and establish this free state of Palestine and create a genuine peace and equity between the two nations and security for everyone. It has, in the same breath, many will have come forward and said, Marwan Barghouti is the man. Marwan Barghouti is seen as the potential Nelson Mandela for the Palestinians. And very immediately after, it is pointed out that this is the reason why Israel refuses to release the man, is because he will succeed in doing this. Not because Israel is per se against the well-being of Palestinians who are currently under Israeli military occupation now for over 40 years, illegal occupation as is dictated by the United Nations, and all those Jewish-only settlements cropping up all over the occupied West Bank, also being declared illegal by the UN, the Geneva Convention statutes, and other sources, most nations in the world not recognizing them. It's not merely because the Israelis don't want to see a state like that which would serve the best purposes of the Palestinian Arab natives who live there, and they are natives, they are indigenous. But because Israel still, quite blatantly, actively, and without denial, covets all of historic Palestine, they consider it to be Eretz Israel, or the land of Israel, they want all of it. They are not genuinely interested. The Israelis are not genuinely interested. And certainly the ruling Likud and the other right-wing party coalition in Israel, and certainly their Prime Minister Netanyahu, are not interested in a Palestinian state. They fervently, almost furiously stated this over and over again, that they did not want to see the emergence of a Palestinian state going back some 20 years ago, even at during the beginnings of the attempted Oslo peace process. They're not really interested. They'll only occasionally pay lip service if pressed by the international press corps and by other nations, particularly by the U.S. They'll come out and say, if there is no Palestinian state, it's not our fault, it's the Palestinians' fault. But they're not really interested in it, which is why they will not, most likely will not, permit the release of Marwan Barghouti, who could be the instrumental linchpin, keystone figure into bringing this reality about, two states. Not to mention true freedom and true democracy for the non-Jew, 20% of the Israeli population, which is not Jewish. And that's really what's behind this. They're not going to let Barghouti go because they don't want to see this happen. They want him to be kept under wraps, out of the way, and allow the Israelis to continue to demonize the Palestinians and their Palestinian Authority, quote-unquote autonomous government, and eventually continue to drive the Palestinians away by force, either by troops, killing them off, or otherwise permitting, tacitly or otherwise permitting, the expansion of Jewish settlement, new Jewish residences, homes, apartments, condominium complexes in the West Bank, the removal and destruction of the houses, now numbering in the tens of thousands since 1967, destruction of the homes and villages, whole villages, literally still. They did this in 1948, 67, and they're still destroying, in some cases, over and over and over, destroying the same villages that the Palestinians, like ants in the insect world, reemerge and rebuild these villages again, as some would prefer to see the Palestinian Arabs as just ants. They're resilient. They come back and they rebuild their villages in the same spot, and Israel keeps under their dubious Israeli laws concerning occupied villages and Arab communities. They destroy them. The IDF itself, with their armored bulldozers, their armored caterpillar bulldozers, knocks the homes down, destroys the olive groves, olive tree groves, and other farmland of the Palestinians to make way for settlement expansion, more new or expanded military bases, and one excuse after the other. In the West Bank, we're talking about, and East Jerusalem. And they continue to actually push the Palestinians out of the West Bank into wherever. In some cases, they may be lucky, fortunate enough to find, if you want to call it good fortune, just be pushed back into other existing Arab villages farther east or to the north or to the south. Eastern, northern, southern perimeters of the West Bank. And eventually, some of them will just get out of there, go to Jordan, go to Lebanon, go to the United States, and hopefully, as in the Israeli mind, leave this land for the Israelis to take all for themselves. This is their history. It may sound like propaganda coming from me, but it is undeniable, indisputable, and documented ongoing history. This is what the Israelis do. It's totally non-conducive to the maintenance of any decent, viable peace talks. But they keep doing it. The other thing I wanted to say was, I saw the word interlocutor in here. There was a gentleman named Keyes, Alan Keyes, I believe, an African-American who ran for the American presidency several cycles ago on the Republican ticket. In addition to his utter, in my mind, disreputable right-wing beliefs, he was an active demonizer of the Palestinians and their leaders to the point of declaring, this is when Yasser Arafat was still alive, declaring that the Palestinians did not make for a reliable or trustworthy partner in the peace talks with Israel. And he used the term interlocutor, which also appeared in the article. I'm scanning the article for it. And stating that in place of any Palestinians, regardless of their status, that the Israelis must go to the Jordanians, to the royal family of Jordan, or to someone else, the Saudis, to Egypt, to Mubarak at the time, and deal for the Palestinians in their place with these other authorities because they would create a more reliable and stable, quote-unquote, interlocutor for the Israelis to to powwow with, so to speak, because you just can't trust Palestinian Arabs. Whether or not you consider any Arabs to be truly Palestinians, you can't deal with them. And this was all in a time of very heavy demonization of the Palestinians' leaders as responsible authorities, when it was really the same garbage going on. It was Israel, in many cases, instigating and supporting this demonization, and to a large degree successfully convincing the United States and the U.S. government that this was the case, that you can't trust the Palestinians. And this is largely the reason why, which frustrated the Palestinian leaders so much and caused occasional intransigence on the PAL leaders, knowing that this behind their backs kind of talk was going on. So there it is. Barghouti was generally liked by the Israelis in the 1990s, in the peace talks of the 1990s, had many friends among them, and was considered, as it says here in the article, a moderate interlocutor, as opposed to an interlocutor which the Israelis didn't want to have with hardline militant Islamists, and didn't want to have with anyone who they were truly afraid of because they might deny the West Bank to them, to the Israelis. Anyway, thank God. Thank the goddess that, or thank whoever. Mr. Keyes is long out of the picture now. But there are many more like him in his wake. Okay, it's 4:05 in the afternoon, 1605 hours Pacific Daylight Time here on the west coast of California. We are Free Radio Santa Cruz, serving Santa Cruz City of at 101.3 FM, and we serve the rest of the immediate universe on our online streaming service at freakradio.org. Freakradio.org, click on the red oval. When you get there, scroll down the main page, click on the red oval. Okay. There is a second Haaretz article that I will read following the musical break. Let's get to it.
صار شنو هو البرد وقتها خالي محيك
والله العظيم انت نعان سيديت كان طرر خايفين نغدا كانوا غروا من تكوينت ياك سيديت
هذا كنيا يان سين شراط
Again, after that short break, let me give you the phone number. Repeat that phone number. Area code 831-427-3772. That is to me, to the studio here. I'm here live this Monday, March 24th, in the year of the Common Era, 2014, at 4:10 in the afternoon. So if that jives with where you're at right now in body and mind, then you know the show is live, 4:10 p.m., Monday, March 24th. Oh, no, it's 4:11. I lied. The line, phone line is open. Area code 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. Let me look at my magic box here to see if anyone is actually listening. And whoa! That's awful. There is a program here that we use, special magic box program that, as the word has it, will tell us how many people who are on the World Wide Web right now are listening to this program. I do not know. I mean, I have my doubts as to whether or not this truly picks up the number of immediate hits on the site, or really tells us who all is listening. There are actually three distinct areas of investigation into that, into those. But of course, there's the rest of Santa Cruz, who nobody, probably with any kind of modern technology, can pick up as far as who's listening to us. There's an unknown number of souls who are tuning in to 101.3 on their FM dial, which is the frequency for Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is the Mideast Migraine Show. My name is Ren. Anyone who is listening who doesn't care to call but would like to say something to me here, send an email to this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. The name of the program is now Mideast Migraines, but the email retains the former name of the program, MideastMadness@G as in George, M as in Melanie, X as in xylophone.com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's the Mideast, the email address for your one-way communication. For those of you who are just too chicken to have a dialogue, no, I'm just messing with your heads there. Don't take that to heart. In spite of my extreme volume and meanness, don't pay any attention to that. I'm so humorous, aren't I? Okay, now, good, we're still recording, and we're still on air. I can hear myself on the in-studio audio monitor, and even behind all the static, I can hear myself on the transmitter. our in-town transmitter, and we are on the internet loud and clear. Back to it. Back to the recent news and fascinating articles. Oh, by the way, that reminds me, I once again wish to apologize to the hundreds of thousands of listeners to this wonderful program and this wonderful community radio service. Dare I say the millions? For the technical problems I was experiencing a week ago today, we have vermin, and I'm talking about rodents. Little mammals in the studio who chew away at our wires, and this seems to have interrupted the link that I was supposed to have with our streaming computer and the other computer, potentially. So I had to do a totally live show, live in the sense of having to read from print, which I always allow for the possibility of four by bringing my briefcase to each and every session here. Read you some really fascinating stuff. I'm going to engage in some more throat spray here. La la dee. No, I shouldn't sing during the spray. I have to inhale. Okay. That always tastes good, and tastes good and feels just right. Feels just right, but it doesn't make my mealy mouth any less mealy, does it? What was I talking about here? Yeah, this is Ren Tawil, your host for Mideast Migraines. Another article from Haaretz. So, yeah, I'm really, really sorry for the difficulties that hopefully did not distract too much from the meat of what I was talking about last week, from the content of the show's performance. So we're operating pretty normally now. Although I notice both the studio computer and my home PC are awfully, awfully slow these days. I'm not sure what's going on. But the fact that it's going on in both locations and two separate computers at least makes me feel better about the non-likelihood that it's only happening with my personal PC at home. Okay, Haaretz. Israeli Defense Minister apologizes for calling the U.S. weak, as in W-E-A-K. Moshe Yaalon tells American counterpart he never meant to show defiance, criticism, or hurt the U.S. with his words. By Barak Ravid, March 19. What is this all about? Again, from Israel's leading news periodical, Haaretz. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon is apologizing for the second time in 2 months about critical statements he made against the U.S. government. In the wake of tremendous anger in Washington, a telephone call between United States Secretary of State John Kerry and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and a personal talk with the Prime Minister, Yaalon told his American counterpart, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, that there was no defiance, no criticism, nor intention to hurt the United States or Israel's relations with its ally, with his words. Yaalon said he sees utmost importance in the strategic relations between the countries as well as in personal relations and mutual interests. He told Hagel he values relations on all levels between Israel and the United States in general and on to the defense level in particular. The defense minister said he has very deep admiration for the relations between the countries and for Hagel on a personal level. He said he valued these relations as Israel Defense Forces chief of staff and continues to do so as defense minister. and that he recognized the full depth and importance of these relations. He added he was fully committed to these relations and cooperation between Israel and the United States in all forms. We'll get to what it was he said very shortly here. Hegel said he thanked Ya'alon for the clarification. He said he recognized that some of the things Ya'alon said were taken out of context. He also said he valued their personal relationship as well as relationships between the countries, blah, 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 and appreciated what Ya'alon had to say about his commitment to those relations. Okay, now, on Monday, last Monday, Ya'alon attacked the United States. That's the wording of this article. He attacked the United States for failing to lead the campaign against Iran. Quote, but at some stage, the United States entered into negotiations with them. And unhappily, when it comes to negotiating at a Persian bazaar, the Iranians were better. End quote, said Ya'alon, speaking during an event at Tel Aviv University, as reported by Haaretz. He said some other things that I may or may not have access to at the moment, too, that were critical of the United States and probably pretty stupid for a defense minister to say. Continuing with this article, Netanyahu spoke on Wednesday with Ya'alon concerning the uproar caused by the latter's remarks. By Ya'alon's remarks, which also criticized American conduct regarding the Ukraine crisis, as well as American relations with China and Asia. Officials from the White House, the U.S. State Department, and the Pentagon became angered after reading Ya'alon's remarks, especially by, quote, taking into proportion the fact that the U.S. annually provides some $3.1 billion of military aid to Israel. How often would you ever read in anybody's press? I wonder if this even appeared in any U.S. press, major U.S. media outlets, that the White House, our State Department, and the Pentagon, or any of them, could ever become angered from reading Ya'alon's remarks. Or even alluding to the fact that the U.S. every year gives over $3 billion of military aid to Israel. How often, folks? Continuing, let's conclude this article. In January, Ya'alon raised the ire of fellow Israeli politicians and the U.S. State Department. This was back in January. After he was quoted by the Israeli daily Yedioth Aharonot, calling Secretary of State John Kerry, quote, obsessive and messianic, end quote, adding that he hoped Kerry, quote, gets a Nobel Prize and leaves us alone. Okay, let's leave that speak for itself. No immediate further comments from me after I very cleverly inserted them in the reading of that anyway. Let me read this one more piece. This from the Ma'an News Agency in Israel. Ma'an News Agency. According to the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, yes, it is still an entity, and yes, it exists in and of itself. The PLO states, 56 Palestinians killed, 897 injured since peace talks began. And an also reassuring of three Israeli soldiers in their full BBDs. Color photo of Israeli soldiers on patrol near the West Bank town of Jenin on November 13 of last year. Bethlehem, Ma'an News Agency. Israeli military forces have killed 56 Palestinians and injured 897 since the resumption of peace negotiations with Israel in July, the Palestine Liberation Organization said on Tuesday. Those are their stats. 56 Palestinians killed, 897 Palestinians injured, which is to say most of them were shot by something or another. Continuing, quote, Israeli violations of international law and human rights continued unabated. Rather than demonstrate goodwill during this period, Israel has done the opposite with the aim of derailing the U.S. peace efforts, led by Secretary of State Kerry, end quote, a PLO statement said. There have been over 500 settler attacks on Palestinian civilians and their property in the occupied West Bank, and Israeli forces have arrested over 3,000 Palestinians in 3,767 military raids. This is so-called IDF army action against Palestinian civilians. The great majority of them, by far, unarmed with anything more than rocks and sticks. IDF military action in apparent congruence at the same time as 500 Jewish settler attacks on Palestinian civilians and their property. Continuing with the article. Israel has also begun work on 10,509 housing units in illegal settlement, while simultaneously demolishing 146 Palestinian homes in this period since the peace talks began last July, said the PLO. Israel began work on 10,509 illegal housing units in illegal territory, while at the same time demolishing 146 Palestinian homes. Continuing, the numbers did not include 15-year-old Naif Yosef Shawamra Abu Akar, who was shot and killed by Israeli forces on Wednesday in the southern West Bank. Witnesses said the victim had been foraging for local plants when he was shot. That's what the witnesses said. But the army claimed he and two others had been vandalizing the security fence. I can easily understand how one could be mistaken for the other. Continuing. Peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians were relaunched in July under the auspices of the United States after nearly 3 years of impasse. Israeli's government has announced the construction of thousands of housing units in illegal settlements since peace talks began. The internationally recognized Palestinian territories, of which the West Bank and East Jerusalem form a part, have been occupied by the Israeli military since 1967. Brings to mind the statistics from that survey that I read closer to the top of this edition of Mideast Migraines. We've got a survey expressing deep dissatisfaction on the part of occupied Palestinians with the so-called peace process, which some spell P-I-E-C-E, process, that peace process. Make your own conclusions so I don't have to explain things to people here. Well, some of you will say, I don't trust the PLO. Yeah, a lot of people don't trust the PLO. And you, people by and large, who say that, don't want to trust the PLO anyway. So that's really all there is to that. Okay. That'll wait till next Monday, or next Saturday, excuse me. Just looking at some stuff here. Of the gazillions of people who listen to this program, some of you may recall that I have recently spoken of a meeting of the National Press Club, which had been in the planning, at least as it had been announced to the public, for a good 2 months or more. The National Press Club hosted an engagement entitled something like Time to Reevaluate the quote-unquote special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. I tried like the Dickens to isolate. They had a date for us, and it was in March. believe it was, this is dated March 16th, so maybe that's when it happened, or a day or two before, the meeting at the press club, that presentation by a number of speakers on the so-called special relationship between Israel and the U.S. And was not able to listen to it live, although I got the impression I'd have to get up at 5 in the morning and look for it on the net. Here, this is sent to me, it's just labeled a truly remarkable C-SPAN video on the Israel lobby, etc. Now, I'm pretty sure when you, it doesn't mention the title of that presentation as I had read it to people on the emails that I had in recent shows, but you see the banners up on the wall behind this guy who's speaking. So let's just go right to that, pull it up here, and listen to this portion of that talk. There's a still picture with the same imagery from those emails, the NAT Summit, or the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship, natsummit.org. That's N-A-T Summit, S-U-M-M-I-T.org, natsummit.org, where I'm sure you can watch and listen to your heart's desire. This is a long talk by at least one speaker, which is over an hour and 19 minutes long. There is just about 25 minutes left in our program. I want to eventually play the whole thing, you know, just as on the Saturday editions of Mideast Migraines. I am reading a few chapters a week from Max Blumenthal's book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. The same kind of thing here. I want to cover as much of the Nat Summit as I can in segments. So here we go, beginning with this one. And we are, okay, that's dead in the water here. Leave us leave.
Hi, I'm Scott Horton from Anti-War Radio again. For those of you who joined us late. Our next panel will address the question, has the lobby captured political parties and the news media? First up will be Jeff Blankfort. He is a journalist and radio programmer at KZYX.
And the bottom headline of this scene on C-SPAN 3 says, U.S.-Israel Relationship, Washington, D.C., National Press Club.
In Northern California, and writes often for counterpunch.org.
Thank you very much. The question I've been asked to address today is, quote, are there Israeli lobby gatekeepers and damage control squads on the left? Speaking from 40 years' experience, the answer is clearly yes. Some years ago, historian and veteran left activist Lenny Brenner, who wrote extensively about Zionist-Nazi collaboration, a taboo subject for Phil over there, described the left as the rear guard of the Israel lobby. He was referring not just to the unwillingness of the left and the anti-war movement to challenge or even speak about the lobby, but to the efforts of these leading factions, all of whom claim to be anti-Zionist, to isolate the Palestinian struggle from protests against South African apartheid and U.S. intervention in Central America in the 80s, while Israel was occupying Lebanon and during the First Intifada, and not to talk about the role of Israel in Central America and supporting South African apartheid. 30 years later, nothing's changed. Same factions are still in control. With Washington also being Israeli-occupied territory, they have every base covered. Little wonder why the Palestine Solidarity Movement has not had the slightest impact on U.S. policy in all the years it's been in existence. Stephen Green, who examined the State Department archives dealing with Israel-U.S. relationship, for his book on the subject, Taking Sides, America's Secret Relations and Militant Israel, concluded that after Eisenhower, quote, Israel and Friends of Israel in America have determined the broad outlines of U.S. policy in the region. It has been left to American presidents to implement that policy with varying degrees of enthusiasm and to deal with tactical issues, end quote. There's a corollary to Green's conclusion. Within the left in general and within the organized opposition to Israel's crimes against the Palestinians and Lebanese peoples, there are similar limits. The parameters in which Israel and its friends in America may be legitimately criticized, without the critic being stigmatized by being called an anti-Semite, have been adapted for misinformation concerning Israel-U.S. relations that has advanced over the years largely by Professor Noam Chomsky and an admitted Zionist, and echoed by largely and most prominently Institute for Policy Studies' Phyllis Bennis. To a large degree, these parameters have been accepted without question by the left, by mainstream religious institutions, and sad to say, by many Palestinians and Arab Americans. They have been spread and enforced by an influential handful of Jewish activists, most notably Bennis, who appears to play an important role behind the scenes with Jewish Voice for Peace and U.S. Committee to End the Occupation, the two most prominent and well-financed groups dealing with the Israel-Palestine conflict on the opposition. In the media, where Jewish domination of this issue is observable, as the late Alexander Coburn once said,
it's
Democracy
snowing.
Now's Amy
it's
Goodman
snowing.
Has been
Looks like it's going to be a white Christmas
app? Gatekeeper for AIPAC and the American Jewish establishment, about which I'll say more in a moment. Given the time limits, I'll focus on two of the most important of what might be called the Chomsky parameters. The first is his insistence that Israel is backed by the U.S. because it is a strategic asset, America's cop on the beat in the Middle East, he has written, and it will not undertake any major action without the approval of the White House. This is simply wrong. It's also the U.S., according to Chomsky, that has led Israel in rejecting an agreement with the Palestinians, implying that Washington's opposition to Israeli settlements is a ruse, another falsehood. His distortion of the facts on the ground became enshrined in stone for the Solidarity Movement in 1983 with the publication of his book, The Fateful Triangle, the United States, Israel, and the Palestinians. That an Israeli soldier is yet to shed a drop of blood on America's behalf, and that Bush's father and son paid off Israel to stay out of both Gulf Wars, hasn't dissuaded Chomsky or his followers from adhering to that position. The result of this, from a political standpoint, has been that the left has allowed members of Congress who publicly support Israel, particularly Democrats, to go unchallenged if they are considered good on other issues. In The Fateful Triangle, Chomsky didn't spare words describing atrocities committed by Israel during the 1982 war in Lebanon, but in a clever bait and switch, he placed the ultimate blame for those crimes not on Israel, but on the U.S. for providing the weapons to commit those crimes. The weaponry was provided, according to Congress, not because of pressure on Israel by AIPAC, but because the Reagan administration approved the invasion. What's telling is there's no mention of AIPAC in his entire book. That a possible reason for Chomsky placing the blame for Israel's crimes at the foot of Washington and the willingness of Israel's critics inside and outside of the Jewish community to accept it is that the alternative is something a few of them, at least publicly, will acknowledge. That those responsible for the plight of the Palestinians were the Zionist Jews and their supporters around the world, who, backed by no imperial power, carried out the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948 and the capture of the West Bank and Gaza again in 1967. To fit that war within his analysis, Chomsky described Nasser's defeat as a quote, favor to the United States. When he said that after 1948, when Israel declared statehood, it was as legitimate as any other state and should be recognized as such by the Palestinians, implying that the theft of their country, their being expelled, and the destruction of 500 Palestinian villages was something they should put behind them. Most critics of Israel, Jews and non-Jews, don't want to acknowledge Jewish culpability for the Nakba because the notion of blaming the Jews has an ugly historical precedent, and they share the fear of provoking anti-Semitism. Thus, on the altar of protecting Jewish sensibilities, the oppression of the Palestinians continues, as does AIPAC's occupation of Congress. Downplaying the influence of the Israel lobby in determining U.S. Middle East policies is the second of Chomsky's parameters and flows from the first. For him, the lobby is just pushing through an open door. I don't write about it, I don't talk about it, he once wrote in explaining why he wouldn't debate the issue. The invasion of Iraq was a major threat to Chomsky's positions, particularly the attention given to John Mearsheimer's and Stephen Walt's excellent book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which attributed the launching of the war to the lobby and punctured the left mantra that it was a war for oil. In response to that book, the first on the subject released by a major publisher in more than two decades, the Rear Guard rallied its forces, essentially linking arms with Alan Dershowitz, to dispute Mearsheimer and Walt's thesis and sully their reputations. First on the attack, ironically, was Palestinian professor Joseph Massad, who had been targeted by a lobby group while teaching at Columbia. His experience had apparently taught him how to behave, and now the lobby leaves him alone. Excessively long attacks on the book followed, one by longtime AIPAC apologist and Chomsky favorite Professor Stephen Zunis, and another by Jewish Voice for Peace's Mitch Plitnik. Amy Goodman's response, however, took the prize for damage control, because as an untouchable icon of the left, and with an ever-widening listening and viewing audience, what she does and doesn't say about is of singular importance. Rather than invite either Mearsheimer, Professor Walt, to be a guest on her program to discuss the book, she brought in Chomsky, who obviously hadn't read it. It was no surprise he dismissed it. Mission accomplished for both of them. The exclusion of Mearsheimer and Walt from Goodman's show, what on this issue should be renamed damage control now, is of course an experience shared by most, if not all, of today's speakers. Telling your viewers and listeners the truth about Israel-U.S. relations, the Iraq war and the build-up to the war in Iran is clearly not on the Goodman agenda. Bringing in Chomsky to throw cold water on the Mearsheimer-Walt book was in keeping with her tradition of ignoring AIPAC. She never reports on the almost unanimous votes on sanctions legislation against Israel's enemies that AIPAC drafts for Congress, nor on its annual policy conferences here in Washington, which are not insignificant events. Even the public confrontation between Obama and AIPAC over new sanctions has rated only a single headline, on which she now intones every day is the War and Peace Report. What Goodman also shares with Chomsky and Bennis, another of her frequent guests, is their silence concerning the network of pro-Israel think tanks that dominate the Washington Beltway. We had to learn about the project for a new American century from the Scottish Morning Herald years after PNAC, initiated and made up of predominantly Jewish neocons, began promoting regime change in Iraq. Today we hear nary a word about its successors, the Foreign Policy Initiative, and the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which sprang into existence the day after 9/11, both of which also are dominated by Jewish neocons. Some of the very same ones. When on a panel here in 2011, during AIPAC's policy conference, I asked an audience of over 100 people who had attended an ostensibly anti-AIPAC event an hour earlier if they had heard of either one of these organizations. Only one hand went up. How many here have heard of the Foreign Policy Initiative? Not many. How about Foundation for Defense of Democracies? Not many. Should wonder why not. Then there's the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, or WINEP, whose resident experts are quoted on a daily basis by the New York Times and other national media on Middle East issues, and who routinely testify before Congress on issues affecting Israel. Who, aside from the present company, knows that it was created by AIPAC in 1985 to do exactly what it is doing now? That its founding director, Martin Indyk, and one of its leading spokespersons, David Makovsky, were appointed by John Kerry to bridge the differences between Israelis and Palestinians during the phony peace talks that are now going on. That should be news, no? No. Not at least for the mainstream media, nor for Chomsky, Bennis, or Goodman, nor for their followers, nor for the left, nor for the Palestinians who they have managed to fool. In his biography, Colin Powell blamed the war in Iraq on, quote, the Jinsa crowd, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. How many readers of this book have ever heard of it? How many people outside of this room? That it has been around since 1976, and that Dick Cheney, Richard Pearl, Gene Kirkpatrick, Paul Wolfowitz, and former CIA Chief James Woolsey have been among its members should be news. No? No. Not for our damage control trio and those who worship them uncritically. One may argue that they know their audience and only say what their audience wants to hear. The role of the gatekeepers is to keep it that way. In 1991, speaking in Berkeley, Chomsky was asked by an Iraqi American in the audience about the role of the Israel lobby in pushing George Bush Sr. to attack Iraq in 1991. To the loud applause of his fans in the audience, Chomsky said the lobby played no role. It wasn't true, but it was what they wanted to hear. Chomsky's fateful triangle was a polemic designed to prove that supporting Israel has been high on the agenda of every U.S. president that followed Eisenhower. When it hasn't, he simply ignores it. That's why there's no mention of Kennedy in his book. Kennedy strongly opposed Israel developing a nuclear weapon and was the last president to do so. He also supported the Palestinian right of return and wanted it implemented to some degree. In the time of his murder, his Justice Department, under Brother Bobby, was engaged in a serious effort to get the American Zionist Council, a creation of Israel's Jewish agency, to register a foreign agent. It became AIPAC. All these positions were red lines as far as Israel was concerned. Why didn't Chomsky mention them in his book or mention them since? Why also didn't he mention Gerald Ford's delaying a major weapons shipment to Israel in 1975? For 6 months when he refused to disengage from Sinai land captured in the 73 war and Ford's concurrent threat to call on Israel to return to the 67 borders, which AIPAC was able to stymie. Later he'd tell his readers that George Bush Sr., who went on national TV to block Israel's request for $10 billion loan guarantees, and who, when vice president, wanted to sanction Israel both after it bombed the Iraq Osiris reactor and after invading Lebanon, he was ardently pro-Israel. Chomsky said he was pro-Israel. The Israelis would find that very ironic. Matter of fact, Moshe Aarons wrote a whole book about attacking George Bush Sr. I believe these historical errors and omissions on Chomsky's part are not accidental any more than those of Goodman or Bennis. We have to answer them with the truth, and this conference is a way to begin. Thank you very much.
All right, next up is Alan C. Brownfeld. He is a syndicated columnist and editor of the Quarterly Journal of the American Council for Judaism.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here and to meet many of my longtime readers in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, with which I have been associated, it seems like, for decades. Now, we all know that Zionism has distorted American policy in the Middle East. At the same time, it has had a terribly negative impact upon Jewish life in the United States and throughout the world. And it is important to remember that historically, Zionism was a minority view within Judaism, particularly in America. The organization whose journal I edit, the American Council for Judaism, was established in 1942, and it was established primarily because the established Jewish organizations which had previously opposed the concept of Jewish nationalism had changed course. So the council was organized to maintain this older view that first, Judaism is a religion, not a nationality, that American Jews are American by nationality and Jews by religion, just as other people are Protestant, Catholic, or Muslim. This was the view maintained by the vast majority of American Jews all through history. In my opinion, it's the view of the silent majority today. Zionism gained a foothold largely because of the reaction to Nazism. Something had to be done in the wake of the horror of Europe. But I just want to give you a little bit of the history so you understand where we're coming from. In 1841, at the dedication of Temple Beth Elohim in Charleston, South Carolina, the oldest Reformed synagogue in America, Rabbi Gustav Poznanski declared, "This country is our Palestine. This city is our Jerusalem. This house of God is our temple." In 1885, when the Union of American Hebrew Congregations was established in Pittsburgh, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, the leading Reform rabbi of the time, was instrumental in writing what was called the Pittsburgh Platform. In it, he declared, "We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any laws concerning the Jewish state." One of the leading Jewish theologians of the 20th century, Abraham Joshua Heschel, said, "Judaism is not a religion of space and does not worship the soil. So too, the state of Israel is not the climax of Jewish history, but a test of the integrity of the Jewish people and the competence of Judaism." And in 1929, a respected Orthodox rabbi, Aaron Samuel Tamarat, wrote that the very notion of a sovereign Jewish state as a spiritual center was a contradiction to Judaism's ultimate purpose. He wrote, "Judaism is not some religious concentration that can be localized or situated in a single territory. Neither is Judaism a nationality in the sense of modern nationalism, fit to be woven into the threefoldedness of homeland, army, and heroic songs. No, Judaism is Torah, ethics, an exaltation of the spirit. If Judaism is truly Torah, then it cannot be reduced to the confines of any particular territory. For as scripture said of Torah, its measure is greater than the earth." It is my opinion that what has happened to American Judaism has completely corrupted its religious nature. What we are witnessing today, synagogues flying Israeli flags, programs urging American Jews to emigrate to Israel, their real homeland, is a form of idolatry, making the sovereign state of Israel the object of worship rather than God. In 1999, the Union for Reform Judaism adopted a resolution saying Israel is central to our religion. Israel, not God. And one of the prominent Zionists, Professor Ruth Weiss of Harvard University, said at one time, "I would rather surround myself with Jews who loved Israel and didn't believe in God at all than with those who believed in God and did not love Israel." It is also my view that Zionism is a subversive enterprise. What would we as Americans think of any religious institution in our society that flew a foreign flag in its houses of worship, that told young Americans that this is not really their homeland, that someplace else is their homeland, and that the highest form of their religious expression is to emigrate to that country. Now, I doubt that very many American Jews believe any of that. Very few American Jews are emigrating to Israel. Yet their religious institutions manifest that sensibility. If you read the Jewish press, whether the Forward or the Washington Jewish Week or local Jewish papers in Los Angeles or Cleveland, you get the feeling that you are reading the papers of an expatriate community. It's as if you were reading the papers of recent immigrants from El Salvador who were reading about the daily events in their home country and were being urged to return. Now, there have been many distortions in American Jewish life. Consider the hypocrisy of American Jewish organizations, which have gone to court to remove voluntary school prayer from our schools, remove Christmas trees from our schools, yet support a theocracy in Israel where there is no separation of church and state. That Israel calls itself a Jewish state, yet non-Orthodox Jews have fewer rights in Israel than any place in the Western world. Reform rabbis have no right to perform weddings or funerals. Conversions by Reform rabbis are not recognized. Israel is not a free society with regard to religion. The question then arises, American Jewish organizations, which dedicated themselves with such fervor to a strict separation of church and state, seem not really to believe in separation of church and state when Jews are a majority. It's interesting that when Thomas Jefferson and James Madison wrote the Virginia Declaration of Religious Freedom, they were not members of a persecuted minority. They were people who believed in religious freedom.
All right, my friends, this is Ren back with you. It's time to move along to the next program, which is Palestine Today, headline show of events in the state of Palestine, a.k.a. the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. Again, in the second half of next show, I have a very important announcement. Next Monday, March 31st, there will be a live interview, assuming everything all goes as is planned, with a gentleman in Morocco. He is Canadian, he is retired, and he wanted to spend his retirement in the company of Muslims, although I do not believe himself to be a Muslim. Although I do not know that for a fact. He has lived in the West Bank under Israeli occupation, in Nablus in particular, as well as Jerusalem. I will be interviewing David, is his first name. Next Monday, as close to the beginning of the program, at 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, again, next Monday, March 31st, on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM in town here, and streaming live at freakradio.org. I will remind you of this event. On Saturday's weekend edition of Mideast Migraines, starting at 11 a.m. local time here. Interview with my friend David, who lives in Morocco, next Monday, starting very shortly after 1500 hours, 3 o'clock p.m. And I expect in the latter half of that program If the interview does not take up the entire 2 hours, which I tend to doubt that it will, I expect to continue with this C-SPAN presentation of the NAT Summit. Details at natsummit.org. Thank you again. This is Ren saying goodbye until Saturday and, of course, Monday at 3 p.m.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, March 24th.